I'll tell you an interesting story. Happened about 9 years ago, 1997. I'm listening to Coast AM out of St. Louis. I just got done with my local show, and Art Bell and Linda Moulton Howe are on, talking with Bill Burns, the author, co-author of the book The Day After Roswell. They're talking about Philip Corso. Riveting. I listened to the whole program, ran out the next day, bought the book, The Day After Roswell. Called up Bill Burns, tracked him down, and said, Bill, I got to have you on my local show. I love this story. And Bill and I became dear friends ever since. I'll be back with Bill Burns, my partner in the book, Worker in the Light, as we talk about that for the rest of this half hour. Then the rest of the entire program, we're going to talk about The Day After Roswell and the life of the late Philip Corso. William Burns is a best-selling author, a magazine publisher, a New York literary publishing agent who has written and edited more than 25 books and encyclopedias in the fields of human behavior, true crime, current affairs, history, psychology, business, computing, and the paranormal. Ah, yes, the paranormal. And he is a friend. William received his PhD from New York University in 1974 while he was an instructor of English at Trenton State College. And he is currently, he just took his bar exam here in California. When will you know if you pass that, Bill?
Well, Thanksgiving, George. Good evening. Hi. And it'll either be Thanksgiving or Thanksgroaning, but I think it'll be Thanksgiving. So we'll know right around the end of November.
You know how long it has been since I had you on a complete program. I mean, you were on a little bit with our fill-in host, George Knapp, back in July. But, man, this brings me back to the old days.
That's right. We would get together on the air and basically talk through the night.
You know, back in 1997, when I first heard you on with Art and Linda Moulton Howe talking about Corso, which we're going to spend most of the night doing so tonight, it was riveting. I mean, the story was riveting. How did you come to meet Corso?
I met Corso, it's so roundabout. In fact, in this issue of the magazine, in the October issue of UFO Magazine, I talk about that. And I met Corso because I was working with a motion picture company at the time, looking to do a story, and Corso was a consultant, on MIAs in Vietnam. And Corso was, he was on the staff handling Little Switch, Big Switch at the end of the Korean War. He'd been on MacArthur's staff during the war. And he was the person who was testifying before the Dornan subcommittee at the House of Representatives, Bob Dornan's committee, on the POWs that we left behind in Vietnam. And he was the point man for Eisenhower in 1953, and basically was the person that Eisenhower told that he knew that we were leaving troops behind in Korea and in China and in the Soviet Union, F-86 Sabre jet pilots specifically, and that I was signing off on it. And Corso dropped a bombshell when he said that to the Dornan committee, and everybody was screaming, who is this crazy old guy? What does he know? He's a right-wing fanatic, blah, blah. You can imagine.
Oh, sure.
And so they did a frantic search through the National Archives to find the document that Corso said existed, and it wasn't there. And the fires got stoked up. This was back, I think, in 1995. And the fires were really getting stoked up until the one place they hadn't looked turned out to be the place where the document was sitting. It was in the Eisenhower Library. And that's where they found this presidential finding in which Eisenhower signed off on troops that we knew would never come home. And in fact, they were living and breathing in Korea into the 90s, into the 1990s. And on the document in Ike's handwriting, it said, pass to Corso. And suddenly this obscure person, who also said there were two Lee Harvey Oswalds at a time when nobody would listen to him, became the lead story on Time and Newsweek magazine. And so we brought him in not to talk about UFOs. Who knew? We brought him in to talk about what was going on in Korea and what the policy was. And he kept on dropping these bombs about different secret programs the U.S. ran, such as using the U-2s as decoys over the Soviet Union to get them to fire their anti-aircraft missiles. I mean, he was just a wealth of information. So we're talking, and he leads us to the Kennedy assassination. He worked for Senator Richard Russell.
Yes.
And he leads us to the Kennedy assassination, told us some mind-boggling stuff about various players who were in the loop that the Warren Commission knew, told us about the conversation that LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover had in the Oval Office the day after LBJ came back from Dallas, in which Hoover said to LBJ, "You know, Mr. President, we did find another Lee Harvey Oswald, and the CIA knows about it." And LBJ hushes him and says, "Yes, I know about that, too. Let's not talk about that to Dulles." And Dulles was on the commission. And I'm telling you, so LBJ is implicated in a cover-up to conceal the identity of what really happened to the death of a president, and so is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. Corso talks about this. The room is silent, and we're all set in this movie company group. I mean, to be blunt, this is Hollywood, and we are literally sharpening our knives and forks. We just see these movies just laying themselves out across the table like a smorgasbord. And then Corso says, "Oh, yes," and this is all after I handled the Roswell file at the Pentagon. Well, everybody, we just look at each other. Shut the camera off because we're videotaping him. Shut the camera off, and we basically get the 25-minute pitch on what do you mean the Roswell file at the Pentagon? And Corso unravels a story that, I mean, by now everybody knows it, but he just goes on and on and on and comes back the next day and drops a series of workbench notes on the table, and that will become dawn of a new age. And he just tells a story, and we were in rapt attention. And there are hours and hours of this on videotape. Some of them turned up, by the way, in the Day After Roswell documentary that was on the History Channel. But that was a smidgen, a tip of the iceberg. So he really told an incredible story, some of which he couldn't even reveal some of the names, and that's how the book started.
Was there a moment, Bill, when you were talking with him and hearing this, that you thought, how could this guy be making this up? Look at his credentials. Look at who he is. What's going on here?
Well, yes is the answer, and one of the things he did was he opened up this file folder. So here's the interesting thing. He opens up this file folder, and he spreads out his military record on the table. And we're looking at this in awe. Now, some of the stuff the other people in the room knew, his work in for MacArthur. But he starts talking about stuff that you and I heard growing up as pieces of history about another time. For example, we both know that Truman very briefly considered, MacArthur was pushing this, dropping nuclear weapons on the Korean bases, the Chinese bases,
yes.
All the mountain passes where the Chinese troops were pouring into North Vietnam and pushing MacArthur back out of Vietnam, back to Incheon. And Corso was talking about, "Oh, yeah," and his gravelly voice, "Oh, yeah, Bill, I know all that." He's talking about this, and then he starts telling you why he was the person picking certain targets. So you say, "Colonel, what do you mean you were the person picking targets?" And he explains that because of his artillery training in World War II, he was an intelligence officer, but he trained in artillery first, that he was assigned to MacArthur's staff as one of the targeting people to pick out which bases they were going to hit with nuclear weapons. And so we said, "Well, what was your consideration?" And he basically said the Soviets had MiG bases, and they were supporting the Chinese air effort in North Korea. And he's talking about how we had 5 or 6 nuclear weapons that we were going to drop on the Soviet bases. And we're all kind of catching our breath and saying things like, "Wow, you know, wouldn't that have started a nuclear war?" And he's chuckling. He's roaring with laughter. He's bouncing up. He's a little guy. He's bouncing up and down in the seat. And he starts talking about, he says the NYPD could have walked in and taken the Russians in 1950 and 1951. They were no match. He's talking about they were having so many problems. They had a nuclear weapon. They couldn't produce them. Stalin was furious. He wanted to get his troops ready. he said we missed a golden opportunity. He sat there and he said, had we dropped those five nukes on those bases in Korea, there would have been the end of the Korean War. We would have never had a problem with Vietnam because there would have been no Vietnam War.
Right.
The French would not have had to leave after Dien Bien Phu. And he just rewrites history right through the 1960s.
That is amazing. All right, let's jump ahead for a bit. We're going to come back to Corso in just a moment, Bill, and so many other things to talk with you about. As the publisher of UFO Magazine, you're also getting some information that not a lot of us get, and I'm going to try to bend your arm as much as I can tonight to get some disclosure out of you. I don't know how much you can say, but you are on a melting pot of information these days, aren't you?
Yes, we are. It's really exciting. There are right now probably three stories that are really bubbling to the surface with people. Will they speak? Will they come forward? Will we get to see the big it? Those are three of the stories that are bubbling, one of which involves a California Air Force base very early in the 1950s. We're really excited about this. Another story, a major magazine has promised to break. Can't say which magazine it is, but in the business that we are all in the paranormal business, you know that there is a taint to it, and you know that somebody will come forward and tell a story. I'll tell a story to Blank Magazine, but I won't to UFO Magazine, because everybody is going to believe, oh, UFOs, it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a story I believe it's weeks away from breaking. I could be wrong, but I think it'll be before the end of the year, in which a major magazine will break a story about a UFO sighting at an Air Force base. It's a real story with a real person who is no flake.
And you're bringing it to us here, right?
You will talk to this person on the air.
This is good. This is good. Bill, let's the 5 minutes or so to go here before the break, and I want to publicly thank you for the work you put into our book, Worker in the Light. I mean, we talk about synchronicity and how some of these things occur, and you can address some of it in what Ingo Swann was working on, and the fact that you finally realized my distant aunt had a lot to do with this entire field. But I've got to tell you, this is my very first book. None of it was possible without you correcting me, fixing things, changing things, taking my ideas, adding your ideas. You did a remarkable job for us, and truly, you were the genius behind this book.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But I really want to thank you, too, and congratulate you on your first book. I think this is going to be a major bestseller. I think everybody should read the book, because in it, you're very open and honest. I mean, a lot of people will tell stories about, I'm a famous radio host, and here's how I started. It was a small station in the Midwest. But what you did was rare. You basically opened up your life, and you said, look, I had a paranormal experience when I was a very young teenager, and it's something most people don't want to discuss. As you and I know, we've talked to a lot of people, and any strange experience gets put right under the table because you're strange, you're weird, you're this, you're that. You talk about it, and you tell readers in Worker in the Light what your path was to Coast to Coast. And I think that's great. I was fascinated by the story. I was fascinated how much synchronicity and the lack of coincidence played a role in your life. One of the telling stories for me that you tell in the book is how you basically defied your higher ups, when you were at a television station in Michigan, and basically thought that when you heard a story come over the wire about a ship that was missing,
the Edmund Fitzgerald,
major story, it's the Edmund Fitzgerald, and there you are at the center of breaking that story to the entire world because you followed your instinct.
I seem to be falling into these all the time, Bill. I mean, like this story I had last night with Hamid Mir, the Pakistani journalist, that now CNN is all over, and they even got the contact numbers from us. I seem to just stumble into this, and I don't know why, and I don't know how, but it seems to happen to me all the time.
And one of the reasons, and you mentioned this in the book, I think in such a way that anybody can pick up on it. This is not a guarded book. It's an open book. And one of the things you say is that you are not afraid, and I think it takes a lot of courage to say that, that you are not afraid to follow instinct, that sometimes there's logic and sometimes there's instinct. And sometimes the two of them disagree and you've got to make a decision. You generally tend to follow instinct because logic can be imposed upon you from elsewhere. And you talk about this in the book. But mainly you tell everyone, don't be afraid to follow your instinct. And you do. And that's why you're breaking the stories you're breaking.
When we were able to get cover comments from people I respect, Whitley Strieber, Uri Geller, Steve Alton, it was to me that really brought it home. You know, when those quotes came back after they reviewed the books and they gave us their comments, I looked at that, Bill, and I said, this is real. This is happening. And it's a great feeling.
Well, I'm so thrilled about Uri Geller and Whitley and Steve and, of course, Tess Gerritsen stepped up.
Right.
I was really impressed. She had read the manuscript, and she knew our editor, and was thrilled about being able to write a cover quote. Uri Geller was really a gentleman. He basically stepped up, and he said to me he was not going to do just another book. He was very honest. He said he was not going to just another book about paranormal. You know, he's been in the field, he knows it all, but then he said if this is a book about becoming a better human being and kind of reaching out beyond the confines of your own self and forming the great link with others, then he was on board. He's all about human empowerment. And the funny story is, of course, that Uri Geller, during the Hezbollah war, was on the Northern Front, and we were text messaging each other about what was going on. And he was there not to fight a war. He was there to take care of people.
Yep, exactly. We had him on briefly when a small missile hit not too close to him, not too far from him.
That's right. He mentioned, yes. And I heard that, and I mentioned that. And he's a real gentleman, and I was just thrilled to have him on the cover. And, of course, Whitley is far more knowledgeable about what we're talking about in the book than most people will ever give him credit for.
He's a giant. You know, when I met him a month or so ago with you and Bob Gleason, our editor, I had talked to Whitley before, but I'd never met him. He's got this demeanor about him. He's got this charisma about him without being, it hasn't tainted him. His success has not tainted him. His lovely wife, Anne, was with him, and she looks remarkable. It was just great to be in this group. And again, you made all this happen. And as you well know, I'm taking a portion of the proceeds, my proceeds, Bill, and I'm giving them to needy Coast to Coast listeners. We've got a list of people. The book is finally on the market. Today was the day. And that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that because it is more important to me to say thank you to these so many people. And I got to tell you, reading some of these emails, they're heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking.
I can only imagine. I get a lot of emails, too, from folks out there who tell me stories of how they've followed their life to search for the truth of UFOs, and they're living in cars, and they've lost their jobs, and they've lost this. And the fact that you're doing this, I mean, it's just beyond generosity. It's saying to an entire audience of people, because this is a community. That's the one thing about America, is that we are a number of communities, and this is a late-night community of not just true believers, but true believers and skeptics and truth seekers, and it's a late-night community. And the fact that there are folks in this community who are in need in some cases because they do belong to this universe, this community, is really an act of generosity. I congratulate you for it, and I thank you for it.
Well, thank you, too. And that's Worker in the Light. It's in the bookstores. It's all over the place now, Amazon.com, written by Bill Burns and me. And thanks to all of you. I think you'll like it. But enough of that. When we come back, the rest of the Philip Corso story and some notes that Bill has obtained, we're going to talk about that as well on Coast to Coast AM. I'll never live that down, will I? Well, I kind of liked it, as a matter of fact. Hey, Bill Burns, in addition to the number of hats he wears, he's the publisher of the Filament Book Club, where they give you a free electronic book. Now, this is one heck of a device. When you join the Filament Book Club and you subscribe to that, then you download your books either right through your computer or right off the telephone. And you can get information on the Filament Book Club by going to filamentbookclub.com or go straight to the coasttocoastam.com website. It's right there on the homepage on coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, along with Bill Burns, a co-author, Worker in the Light, and also the co-author of The Day After Roswell, publisher of UFO Magazine. How many hats do you wear, for crying out loud, Bill?
A lot, but, you know, the weather changes, and you got to change your hat.
Well, you do a great job with UFO Magazine, and you've done a stupendous job ever since you took over. I've seen the direction of it change, the content change, and, you know, you've turned it into an investigative magazine, and I like that.
Well, thanks. And a lot of that credit, I wish I could kind of reap it across the table, but I can't. A lot of it goes to the editor-in-chief, my wife, Nancy, who basically works very hard at getting the kinds of stories. And just for the end of this year, I mean, for example, we have potentially some, besides the ones we talked about, a really great story coming up on the Kinross case, which is the case of the jet that crashed in the Great Lakes. Was it going after a UFO? Did it get lost? We've got the photographs. The photographs are going to be pretty stunning. We have another case coming up from a publisher in which this woman who claims she has photographed aliens. I don't know. Let the Coast to Coast audience, let our readers be the judge. We're going to be running those photographs. And I said to her, if these look good, I'm just going to show them to you. And if there's somebody seeing aliens, maybe you want to interview that person. I don't know. So we have some really good cases coming up. Let's see. We have some wonderful UFOs on the moon coming up before the end of the year.
Oh, that's dramatic stuff. Dramatic stuff. You know, when Ingo Swann remote viewed the moon and he saw these structures and put it in his book, Penetration, I got to tell you, Bill, I mean, if there was, you know, half of me said, come on now, what's happening to this guy? But my late aunt loved him. And I don't mean in a romantic sense, but she just loved the guy and thought he was everything that you could imagine that was right with the supernatural, the paranormal, and the unusual. She thought he was right on.
And he was. Ingo Swann, besides being a gifted psychic and a very talented artist, and you could actually visit his site on the internet, and you'll be able to see the kinds of drawings he has and the drawings he did about the aliens. But Ingo Swann tells this unbelievable story in Penetration, and it's the story he told your aunt, Dr. Caragula, about the aliens on the moon. In fact, the funny thing was when she told him that she knew all about it before he told her that. That was pretty funny. But he goes to the moon. He's remote viewing the moon. And he actually called me back in 1998 about this to say, you know, Corso was right about aliens being on the moon because I saw them. And I, just like you, I said, yes, this is great. I knew about Ingo Swann. I knew about the books he was writing. And then he begins to describe it. Then he says something that was so chilling that, it's in Worker in the Light, but it was so chilling that it has stayed with me for almost 10 years. He said he's seeing these entities, and they're not monsters, they're not ghouls, they're not reptiles, they kind of look a lot like us, and he describes them as very robotic looking, and they're methodical, and they're kind of working on an assembly line.
What was the incredible story that he talked about, meeting an extraterrestrial, seeing an extraterrestrial, in a grocery store?
Oh,
now, that's got to be one of the weirdest things I've ever heard.
It is, and I'll tell you, it set my mind off in a way. I mean, it alerted me to things. He tells the story that after all of this happened on the moon, And the aliens on the moon working in this factory, he said, look up, and they see him. And he said, did he disturb some kind of a force in the universe?
And again, this is when he's remote viewing now, right?
He's remote viewing, and they look at him. And can you imagine that horrifying thing when he's kind of psychically there and invisible, but they see through his psychic camouflage, and they're watching him, and he knows they recognize him. And he said, I split that scene so fast, I broke the link. Now he's in L.A., because he flees to L.A.
Right.
Right? And I don't know what...
Where my aunt lived.
That's right. She was living here at the time. And I want to say it was in the Chalet Gourmet on Sunset. I'm not sure where. I have to ask him. But it's in arrest. It's in this supermarket. And he sees this woman who looks like an alien. And I think she's looking at over the vegetable aisle or something. She likes bananas. And she looks at him, and he looks at her, and he gets this deep, deep fear. And he gets out of there, and he tells his agency contact, and who knows what agency this is.
Right.
He tells his agency contact, this guy named Axelrod, about this alien. And he says, he says, oh yes, I know about that, and you better be careful now, because she's after you. So that night he's going to dinner at Shafika's, and he tells her the story, and your aunt says, oh, yes, be very afraid. She gets nervous.
Yeah.
She says, get out of here. And this is right about the time that he goes up to Alaska with Axelrod, and this UFO starts firing at him.
It's amazing. Great story.
It's a great story.
And she was a believer in all this. You know, when she changed her entire life, her direction. I mean, she's a medical doctor. I mean, she used to work, you know, for the government. She was from the Middle East. I mean, she knew things that most Americans have no idea has been going on over the years. She decided, I'm going to change. And she changed her entire career.
She sure did. And she became the founder. And this is no small event. She was at the center. She was at the center of the whole mass consciousness movement in California in the 50s and 60s. She literally was one of the key people who began what now today is New Age. In fact, she was the Madame Blavatsky of the entire movement in California in the 1960s, and that became New Age.
And you know what? We still really don't know as a family what really happened to her. I mean, we've always been told she was taking a bath and the radio somehow fell into the tub and she got electrocuted. Bill, I'm not so sure.
That sounds really suspicious to me. First of all, she knew an awful lot, and she told Ingo Swann that she worked for the same agencies that he was dealing with. So she was obviously in the know. She certainly knew about aliens. In fact, she was telling him, be really afraid of these aliens. They're here, they're everywhere, and they know about you. And she also made it very, very clear that there were aspects, and this is what I think the most dangerous thing. If you want to know what I think the most dangerous thing she said was, what she believed, what she knew, it was this. She said that human, and she wrote this in the book, Higher Sensory Perception, she said that human beings have abilities that human beings don't know about. It goes beyond ESP. It goes beyond something magical. Where it goes to is a whole range of abilities to get impressions, to perceive, to communicate, to see the future, to live by intuition. This is why I think that you're deciding to follow your intuition in certain areas when you get that intuition signal is such a good thing. Well, she said that. And I'm telling you, because I know from the Corso of the Navy, who's now dead, but there was a Corso in the Navy, and his name was George Hoover. And what he said was that was the secret. Right then and there, and this goes right to the heart of what a caller said earlier tonight about what's going to stop the hatred. He said, this is what the government does not want you to know. That's what they want to keep from you. And now, here you are, in our generation, working in the field of mass consciousness, which is what Shafika was researching 40 years ago.
I wonder what she'd say today if she knew what I was doing now.
I think she'd be very encouraging. I think she would really prod you to go further. I think she would say, look, don't listen to the people who say that mass consciousness is dangerous, because you've been told that. I think that what she would say is you can make a kind of a spiritual breakthrough to demonstrate to people that people control their own destinies, and it is this overlay of the world. What you are told to do, you're told to walk in lockstep, you're told to be regimented, that's the enemy, that's evil, that's satanic. What you're doing is not satanic. You are trying to reach a higher level. And I think that's what's going to happen with humanity. I think that there's a general tie-in, again, not to be New Age, but that there is a kind of a general tie-in between what we're talking about with Corso, what he discovered in the Roswell file, what the folks in the Navy discovered, what other people discovered subsequent to the Roswell crash, such as Mac Magruder, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, who, with his class at National Air War College, went to Wright Field in late July 1947 mm-hmm. and saw the alien. What all these folks discovered, there is a greater truth behind this. And I think that Shafika was onto that truth, and I think that she was pursuing that goal. So, of course, she was a threat.
What do you think she would have asked Philip Corso had the two of them met?
I think she would have been very specific about when you were handling the debris in that, and it was debris. I mean, we're not talking about finished products. We're talking about crash debris.
Crash pieces.
Yeah, crash pieces. When you were handling that debris in the Pentagon, what were you thinking? Because Shafika did believe that there was a presence to objects themselves. Again, it's not mystical, it's not magical, it's that objects do radiate a certain kind of an energy, they vibrate, human beings vibrate, and that there is a scientific, there is a kind of a transfer of vibrational energy from object to person who handles it. So that's why psychics who can handle somebody's scarf and then find the person later on, that's not a mystery. She would have said, what were you thinking? Did you get any impressions? Did anything flood your mind? And Corso was very receptive to that. There are a lot of stories about that Corso told me about his quote-unquote psychic experiments. And she would have asked him about that, and I think he would have told her very bluntly how his relationship to that material went back all the way back to 1947 and through the 1950s when he was stationed in New Mexico at Red Canyon.
When Corso was talking to you when you were putting together the manuscript for the day after Roswell, did he ever tell you why he was doing this?
Sure. He told me why, and I had my own opinions, and I'll be frank about both. Corso fully believed that he was supposed to tell the story. Again, it's not as though the aliens were spurring him on. It's not that kind of thing. But one is that he basically was the last man standing of that group. There were others. I think there was a General Samad. One of them was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. I think this was after General Trudeau had died. In fact, he began talking about this after Trudeau had died. And Trudeau writes about this in his notes. He doesn't say aliens, of course, but he writes about what they were doing at Army R&D in his memoirs, which anybody can get, by the way, from the Army War College. Okay.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, anybody can get his memoirs. They're not classified. They're a great read. We've reprinted parts of them, by the way, in UFO Magazine and in the upcoming Dawn of a New Age that we're doing both in the United States in English and with Jaime Musan in Mexico at Planeta Publishing. We're going to have bits and pieces of Trudeau's memoirs in that. Well, and that'll be a filament ebook too as well. What Corso said was that there was a lot of confusion about what he believed happened after Roswell. But Corso's impetus, and here's where it gets interesting, he wasn't here to tell the story of aliens and alien artifacts. He was here to tell the story of how his group in Army R&D was able to outwit both the KGB and the CIA in getting this material out into the open that they wanted to harvest for themselves. So for Corso, this wasn't a UFO story. It was spy versus spy.
And he was very proud of what his department did.
Absolutely. There was no two ways about it. He said, we did it above board. We did it out in the open. He said, we did it the good old American way. I walked in with a chunk of money to Fort Belvoir, and I walked in with that inner lens from the alien's eyeball that they took at the Walter Reed Army Hospital during the autopsy. I walked in there, went to the site, and I said, listen, this is under secrecy. You are sworn to secrecy. National Security Act, whatever act was in force at that time. They said, yes, Colonel. He slapped the alien eyepiece down, basically slaps down a budget and says, look, there's $60 million in this for you. If you can take this, you're already working on night vision, right? Take this and develop this into a set of goggles or eyepieces or a helmet or something that our troops are going to need in Vietnam, because believe me, we're going to need this in Vietnam. The Army back in 61 knew we were going to fight
it. Incredible. How about the silicon chip? How about the laser? Did that come from all that too?
Yeah, there was a laser. He says that there was a laser cutting tool in the file. Nobody knew what that thing was. And although, in fact, the Army was working in with Columbia University. And remember that Eisenhower had been the president of Columbia University. It was kind of a holding spot for him before he got the Republican nomination in 1952. But the Army had a lab at Columbia where they were working on lasers. They were very, very primitive. And the Maser had already been discovered. It was already developed, and they were looking for applications for it. But the whole premise of this is not that Corso said, oh, look, what's this? Let's reverse engineer it and invent it. He went to the very places where those kinds of experiments were going on because he knew, they knew what to do with it. So, of course, he went to the Army lab at Columbia with this laser cutting tool, and he told them the story of scientists not knowing what it was. It burned somebody's face. They held it against a wall. They couldn't see a beam, but it began to smoke in the wall. Somebody blew smoke through the beam, and you could see the beam being illuminated, the outlines of it, by the smoke itself. So it was some kind of a particle beam or a beam of waves. They knew what it was at Columbia, and that jumped them light years ahead, no pun intended, of what they were working on. Same thing with the integrated circuit. This was not anything that we were not working on in the 1960s.
Okay, 1947 was the crash. When did Corso start giving the pieces away to industry to try to duplicate this?
He came to Army R&D in 1961.
61.
And what happened was this. First of all, there was an attempt to, because he mentions this in his memoirs and in the book. He mentions that Truman, after the crash in 1947, they didn't know what they had. I mean, it's the height of the Cold War. I mean, we've gone over the story 100 times with 100 different people. Yes, it was the Cold War. It was right not to disclose it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Truman asked Nathan Twining, what is the least common denominator of technology that we can harvest from this? What can we do with this stuff? And I'll tell you my own doubts about this, by the way, about the story. But and they took this circuitry. They didn't know what it was. They took the circuitry to Bell Labs because they knew that Brittain and Shockley were working on something to replace what was basically the Edison tube. And if you know the Edison light bulb, the incandescent tube,
right,
that had been the mainstay of passing circuitry since the 1890s. So this was a 19th century technology, and they were working on a way to make a solid state circuitry.
Let's talk about the propulsion when we come back, Bill, and see if they were able to find out anything.